authors take the position that you cannot relate to craziness. I know of many marriages that came to a quick end because, as one of the parties would later say, "The guy I married turned out to be really, really crazy." Or, "She was a real nutcase." Or, "I don't know what happened. After the wedding, he started acting really bizarre." When you really stop and think about it, I'm not sure that we even have a very good handle on what normal is. Everybody you know has some characteristic that is different. Even though that characteristic may not be what you or even they might choose in a perfect world, it should not be allowed to frighten or dominate your thinking about who they are. And that applies to your relationship. So long as the quirks and nuances are not abusive to you or blatantly destructive to your partner, you can certainly learn to live with them. My father and I shared a clinical practice for some years and once worked jointly with a family that included a husband and wife and three teenage daughters. To be completely honest, the mom was schizophrenic. She would routinely hear voices, particularly in the late afternoon before the children got home from school. However, when she wasn't talking to someone that wasn't there, she was sweet, kind, and highly talented in many areas. Now, I'll admit this is not exactly the kind of thing I would consciously look for in a mate, but unlike most psychotics, the woman basically functioned pretty well and took excellent care of her family. She was absolutely devoted to her husband and children. Her hallucinations were fairly benign and non-disruptive to the family and home. Still, this was behavior that was worthy of change, and Carol Ann herself wanted to be better. Her husband, Don, attended therapy sessions 100% of the time that he was asked and was 100% behind his wife. With his support, Carol Ann did ultimately make some progress. I say some progress because in one of our later sessions, when she had reportedly not heard a voice for 14 days in a row, the longest period of silence ever, she added a few details that concerned me. When I asked her if she was hearing any voices, she said she was not. When I asked her if she completely and fully understood that they were hallucinations and not someone trying to possess or control her, she also answered in the affirmative, but added that just to be on the safe side, she had cut every wire in the home's intercom system. She did so based on the theory that if they did decide to start talking to her again, they wouldn't be able to do it using those built-in speakers. Not what I would call a cure, and again, not what I would refer to as a desirable characteristic, but the couple and family found a way to deal with it. That couple has now been married 37 years and could not be happier in their intercomless home. Sometimes we feel that because something is not mainstream, then it must be toxic to the relationship. And that's not necessarily true. Everyone has quirks and odd personality traits, and they can sometimes seem bizarre. If your partner's quirks and nuances are non-abusive to you and non-destructive to him or her, you can work on them. But at the same time, you can also accommodate them and enjoy a rewarding and fulfilling relationship. Even craziness can be made to work. Myth number 9. There is a right way and a wrong way to make your relationship great. Nothing could be further from the truth. There is not some etched-in-stone right way to be in a relationship. There is not a right way to show support or affection. There is not a right way to raise children, relate to your in-laws, handle disputes, or any other challenges involved in a complex relationship. What is important is that you find ways of being together that work for you. Whether or not what you're doing meets some standard that you find in a book or conforms to what your mother or father think you ought to be doing should not become some standard you use in measuring your relationship. The litmus test for you should be whether or not what you and your partner are doing is generating the results that you want. It's not important that you follow particular principles. It's important that the two of you are comfortable with the principles that work, and then you write your own rules. Red alert. In addition to avoiding rigidity about your own thoughts, feelings, or behaviors, it is important that you not be rigid and judgmental about your partner's thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. There is, for example, not a right way or wrong way for your partner to love you. If he or she shows love in a way that is different from the way you think it should be displayed, that does not mean that you are right and your partner is wrong. More importantly, it does not mean that the quality of what your partner is giving you is less than it would be if he or she were thinking, feeling, or behaving in the way that you have arbitrarily decided is right. Don't get hung up on trying to conform to some made-up set of behaviors concocted by people who have never even met you or your partner, or who at best see you for an hour a week. Focus on what works. Let's say your partner expressed genuine love to you in a foreign language that you could not understand. Conclusion? You could think that your partner had no love and commitment for you. The frustration for your partner in this situation, however, is that this might be the only language he or she speaks. So he or she did not choose a mode of expression that is precisely that which you or some therapist has decided is correct. Does that fact make your partner's feelings for you of any lesser quality or value? I have always been a cat lover, and I remember early in my relationship with my wife, Robin, I sent her a cat card. There was a drawing on the front of the card showing two cats from behind sitting on a fence. One was kind of a masculine-looking, scroungy alley cat, and the other was drawn as a fluffy, pretty female cat. Their tails were slightly intertwined, and they were looking at the moon. When you opened the card, it simply read, "If I had two dead rats, I'd give you one." She was probably a little perplexed. I, on the other hand, was intending to send a very clear message. Despite its humor, the card really expressed my genuine feelings. Yes, lots of us could work much harder at expressing our love and devotion to our partners, but lots of us could work equally hard at learning our partner's foreign language. If we learn our partner's language, instead of demanding that they adopt our language, we may find that we have far more of what we want than we think we do. It would be tragic for you to miss quality offerings of love and devotion from your partner because you fail to recognize the value of a really good dead rat. Resist being rigid in your own modes of relating, and resist being judgmental about your partner's modes of relating. Do what works. Myth number 10. Your relationship can only become great when you get your partner straightened out. Many of you still have this childlike notion that you don't have to take too much responsibility for finding your own happiness. You still believe the fairy tale that falling in love means finding someone who is going to make you live happily ever after. And when the fairy tale turns out to be untrue, you want to point the finger, to blame, to believe that all the unpleasant things you are experiencing in your relationship are being caused by your partner. Your unhappiness, you believe, is a result of your partner's deeds. Your life would be so much better, you say to yourself, if your partner would just change. As a result, you conclude, there's little you can do until your partner shapes up his or her act. When I have counseled with people in distress relationships, I have asked them who, if they had the choice, they would most like to influence. Their answer is invariably that they would most like to influence their mates. You're probably no different. You assume that if you could just modify your partner's thinking, feeling, and behavior, your relationship would be so much better. That's a myth. The most important person for you to influence is you. You are the most important person in this relationship, and you must be the focus of your beginning efforts to change this relationship. You must rediscover your own dignity and self-esteem, your own personal power. You cannot reconnect with your partner if you are not reconnectable. Understand that I am not saying you are to blame for the problems that may exist in your relationship, but I am saying that you are, at the very least, jointly accountable for the current state of your relationship. If your relationship is not everything that you want it to be, then it's your thinking, your attitudes, and your emotions that need challenging. You have chosen the thoughts, feelings, and behaviors that are creating the pain in this relationship. You have chosen your thoughts, feelings, and behaviors just as surely as you choose the clothes you wear each day, the car you drive, and the place where you work. You have chosen these thoughts, feelings, and behaviors because at some level they work for you. At some level, these characteristics or interactive patterns have provided you with a payoff that has reinforced the recurrence of these behaviors. If you find the payoffs, you have found the lifeline that keeps the destructive behaviors alive and recurring. Once you identify the payoffs, you can shut them off and remove them from your life. Once the behavior no longer works for you, once it fails to generate you some payoff, it will cease to occur. I once encountered a crystal clear example of this concept of payoffs with a newly married couple. Apparently, Connie was insanely jealous of Bill and lived with a horrible and gripping fear that he would violate their marriage vow. She felt that he would either leave her or have an affair during his frequent job-related travels. Connie would call and page him incessantly throughout the day to verify his whereabouts and his activities. In one day, she had called or paged him 17 different times. Each contact was the same. Are you with any other women? Have you flirted with anyone? Do you think they're prettier than I am? Do you wish you were with them instead of me? You don't love me, do you? You think I'm ugly and boring and uninteresting, don't you? Bill consistently and patiently reaffirmed his love and commitment to her. He denied the presence of other women, even if they were involved with him in work-related ways. He constantly reassured her in terms of his commitment, fidelity, and appreciation for her and her attractiveness. This pattern continued on until both were so addictively involved in it that it was destroying their marriage. She could think of nothing else, and he had become a slave to the phone, beepers, and constant reassurances. Both professed a desire to stop it. My question was, if you don't like it, why don't you quit doing it? You're not stupid people. You have the ability to make a choice, so make it and quit whining about it. Both said they wished that it was that easy, but that try as they might and commit as they would, they constantly returned to the pattern. They both expressed frustration and confusion over why they would consciously do what they didn't want to do. The answer is probably as obvious to you now as it was to me then. Both Connie and Bill were getting some kind of sick payoff out of this destructive interactive pattern. As the interactions wore on, it became apparent that Connie was terribly insecure personally. Duh. But the real revelation to her was that she was feeding on the constant reassurance, placated each time he passed the test. She was getting an ill-gotten gain of reassurance and recommitment every single day. She became so addicted to the need for this that it controlled her. Bill, who seems like the poor victim in this whole thing, undoubtedly got a sick ego trip from being so valued, pursued, and worried about. It stroked his ego that his wife was so obsessed with him. But soon, like all addictive behaviors, both Connie and Bill became slaves to their addictive payoffs. She was going to have to make a decision about whether she wanted to nurse this sick, green-eyed, narcissistic, and self-destructive monster that dominated her every waking hour, or grow up and take the risk of letting herself love and trust. It was also clear to me that if she didn't, Bill would be out of there and out of there soon. Bill had to decide whether to be controlled by the ego trip or mature into a more healthy partnership. Instead of waiting for your partner to change, you can and will serve yourself much better by looking at yourself instead of your partner. What kind of payoffs are you affording yourself that are keeping your self-destructive patterns alive? You may find that it is now obvious or that it is still hidden. Either way, make no mistake, there is a payoff there. You are no exception to the rule because there are no exceptions to the rule. So you can either stay self-centered and keep blaming your partner, or you can make the choice to be self-directed and start working for real change. You can either fill yourself up with an impotent anger at your partner, or you can choose to get busy and stimulate your relationship to get headed into the right direction. But never think that you can control your partner. And never think that it's up to your partner to make your life better. You are in charge of yourself. Believing in myths is not the only way you poison your relationship. There's an even more insidious technique that you use to harm the very thing that's most important to you. That's when you approach your relationship with what I call your bad spirit. Every one of us has a bad spirit, an irrational and destructive emotional side to our personalities. There is a part of each of us that is immature, selfish, controlling, and power-seeking. If you are being honest with yourself, about yourself, you know, of course, exactly what I am talking about. Unfortunately, it's during relationship interactions, the most emotionally charged part of your life, the place where you have the greatest personal stake, when your bad spirit can leap out of you. There can be astonishing hostility and cruelty, childlike defensiveness, pathetically immature reasoning, accusations and counter-accusations, blaming and shaming, exaggerations and denials. When your bad spirit comes roaring out, you are the most disconnected from your core of consciousness as you can get. Most of you find this side of yourselves so distasteful that you cannot and will not face it. You have a stockpile of denials to justify and explain away your terrible behavior. You like to think instead of how you are when things are going well in your relationship, and you act mature, giving, flexible, and democratic. But your bad spirit is always there, always lurking, and it's when the water gets rough, when you get frustrated, threatened, and hurt, that you give in to your dark side. Allowing this ugly side of who you are to take control can and will cause your relationship to fail. Not some of the time, but all of the time. Regardless of what else might be right with the relationship, your bad spirit, if left unattended, will poison every fiber of your relationship and seal its fate. Because this aspect of yourself can be so devastating, you can't afford to be defensive about it or pretend that it doesn't exist in hopes that it will go away. Nor can you rely on traditional, conventional therapy in which you spend session after session with someone trying to understand where these attitudes come from, doing some analysis, perhaps, of what your mother or father did to you. Well, that can be entertaining mental masturbation, but it is little else. I can't change whatever happened to you as a child that may have influenced the way you are now behaving, and you can't change it either. The most important thing to realize is that you are not a child anymore. You are now an adult, and you have the chance to choose what you think, feel, and do. If you have a tough history, I'm sorry. I really am. I don't mean to make light of or minimize suffering that you may have been through. I've heard stories that were so horrible that they make me physically sick to my stomach. If you are one of those stories, I absolutely hate that for you. But there's only one thing worse than having terrible things happen to you in one phase of your life, and that is to mentally and emotionally carry those terrible events and feelings into the next phase of your life. If you are one of those who tragically suffered through such an event, you cannot hide behind it. You cannot use it as an excuse to justify this dark side. You'll just keep the suffering alive by transplanting it into your current life. Going through the next section of this audiobook will not be fun, because we are going to look at the most typical ways that this bad spirit shows up in a life and shows up in a relationship. But remember, you cannot change what you do not acknowledge. Have the courage to get real about this dark side, and you can take control. Bad spirit characteristic number one, you are a scorekeeper. A healthy relationship is clearly a partnership. Partners cooperate, they support one another, and they depend on one another. They do not compete. Some competitive hardheads may be thinking, competition? I'm possessed by a bad spirit if I feel competitive? Yeah, right. When it comes to your relationship, however, that's exactly right. Please understand, I think there's nothing better than a great banter between a man and a woman. I love watching a couple playing their games of verbal volleyball, teasing one another, swapping funny stories, joking about the other's eccentricities. There's a great spark to their relationship, a feistiness that makes it fun. That's not competition. That's love with a sense of humor and with abundant spirit. But competition, real competition between partners, can quickly turn a relationship into a battle of one-upmanship that can turn ugly. Competitiveness means scorekeeping. And if you allow your life with your partner to be guided by a tit-for-tat trading of favors and duties, and I'll do for you if you'll do for me scorekeeping, you are in danger of turning what should be a mutually cooperative and supportive relationship into a fight for leverage and the upper hand. Solid relationships are built on sacrifice and caring, not power and control. Think about what we're talking about here. Competition, by its very nature, means that you have an adversary, an enemy. How can you possibly be a winner if it's at the expense of making the person you supposedly love a loser? How can you possibly expect to enjoy harmony in a relationship where one or both of you are fighting for leverage, power, and control? Solid relationships are built on sacrifice and caring, not power and control. The joy of giving is completely lost when a husband picks out a beautiful dress and gives it to his wife, not as an act of kindness, but just to build up brownie points so that she is in his debt and under his thumb. Or a wife who stays home babysitting the kids so her husband can go fishing with his buddies, not because she wants to give him a relaxing gift, but because she wants him to owe her big time. This is not a couple that is attempting to be mutually supportive. These are two people who are each trying to get the upper hand in order to control their partner. Of course, it never occurs to either partner that with genuine caring and giving, their mate would probably volunteer more than could ever be demanded of them. Here are some telltale warning signs that you can use to determine whether or not competition has replaced cooperation in your relationship. You tend to keep score of things your partner does, such as leisure time, outings with friends, hours with children, and chores completed. You make sure your partner never gets the upper hand and never gets by with a freebie. You bank points, which are held over your partner's head for leverage. You make concessions in a negotiating fashion rather than offering them as a gift of support. You seldom, if ever, do something in support of your partner without making sure that he or she knows it, including a detailed explanation of the great imposition it created for you. In any type of dispute or confrontation with your partner, you actively seek outside allies in the form of family and friends in an effort to shift the balance of power. And lastly, you insist on having the last word or the final act of defiance. You and your partner are a team. You're supposed to be mutually supportive. The spirit of competitiveness, however, assures that there is a negativity in the air that can drain the joy, confidence, and productivity from any situation. Bad spirit characteristic number two. You're a fault finder. There is nothing wrong with legitimate criticism or input in a relationship. There is nothing wrong when one party complains about the attitudes or actions of another, if that complaint is designed to improve the relationship. But constructive criticism too often gives way to constant fault-finding, in which you obsess over the flaws and imperfections rather than finding value in your partner. You're almost always telling your partner, in one form or another, what he or she should be doing. You get used to making criticisms, and once you start, it's hard to stop. In fact, no matter what your partner does or how hard he or she tries, it's not enough or it's never as correct as you wish it to be. If your partner had 10 things to do and did 8 of them to perfection, you would spend 90% of your time talking about the 2 things that did not get done. Even if you think I'm not describing you, take a brutally honest look at yourself here. This is an attitude that can sneak up and quickly overtake you. Think back on the last time you said something critical to your partner and the last time you said something positive to him or her. Which statement did you make with the most passion and intensity? Here are some telltale warning signs that you can use to determine whether or not critical perfectionism and a bad case of the shoulds dominate your relationship style. First, you seldom, if ever, let an infraction by your partner slide by, regardless of how trivial. You find yourself saying such things to your partner as, "You should have known better. You should have helped me out when I was stressed. You should have done what I wanted without me having had to ask you." You tend to say always and never when criticizing your partner. "You never help me out in the kitchen. You always ignore me." The terms always and never are judgmental and argumentative. They also should be embarrassing to the one using them because such absolute statements are typically unsupportable. You counterattack with criticism whenever you're being criticized yourself. Your partner, for instance, tells you that you forgot to take out the garbage. Instead of hearing the message, your competitive attitude and critical spirit kicks in, and you counterattack. "I can't believe you have the nerve to say that. You never do what you're supposed to do. I'm 50 times more reliable than you are. You don't even lock the door at night." Or lastly, you are obsessively interested in getting your partner to admit wrongdoing rather than listening to what your partner has to say. If you are controlled by this bad spirit and think your critical perfectionism is making your partner a better person, think again. What you are doing is nothing more than making your partner more confused, more anxious, and perhaps more resistant to your legitimate criticisms. And even more important than the criticism you are creating, you are driving your partner away. Get off your partner's back, and you may see your partner moving toward rather than away from you. You will also start realizing that you have a lot of work to do on yourself, and no amount of criticism of someone else is going to improve you. Bad spirit characteristic number three. You think it's your way or the highway. This particular bad spirit goes a step beyond competitiveness and criticism. Here, you become self-righteous. You turn unyieldingly rigid. You are obsessed with control. Everything has to be your idea and everything has to be done your way. No other method than yours, however sufficient it might be, is acceptable. As a rigid controller, you are intolerant of initiative by others and expect them to be passive puppets to your ideas and wishes. You refuse to recognize or acknowledge contribution by your partner. You cannot and will not admit that you are wrong because you are addicted to rightness. The message to your partner is clear. I am better than you. I cannot imagine a more self-defeating spirit than this one, for you are putting your own ego above the welfare of the relationship. You will let the relationship go down in flames rather than be honest about your own shortcomings. Here are some other good warning signs that you can use to determine whether or not self-righteousness is the master you serve. You are intolerant of your partner's initiatives or ideas. You regularly interrupt your partner during conversations so that you can get in what you want to say instead of patiently allowing your partner to finish what he or she has to say. You cannot end a confrontation until your partner acknowledges that you are right. If your partner won't admit the rightness of your position, you tend to sulk or act like a martyr, making sure your partner understands that you don't feel appreciated. You regularly assume a saintly, pious position with friends and family, telling them all about what you have to put up with, about how your partner is impossible to live with. You tend to start sentences with guilt-inducing phrases like, if you loved me, or if you cared for me, or with, I told you so, you should have listened. You must examine yourself with a very critical eye to make sure that you're not sabotaging your relationship in this way. By putting on the cloak of self-righteousness, what you're really doing is keeping yourself from looking at your own faults. Bad spirit characteristic number 4. You turn into an attack dog. This characteristic is so easy to trigger and so hard to undo. How many times have you started out discussing an issue and ended up ripping into your partner with a personal attack? You genuinely believe you are going to stay in control during the discussion, but then you suddenly bail out on the topic or issue and lay waste to the dignity of your partner. And once you get going, you have trouble walking away from the confrontation. In the blink of an eye, the interaction becomes open warfare. Sometimes our viciousness is blatant and easily recognizable. We can spew out the kind of vitriol that would shock anyone within earshot. But sometimes our viciousness comes out in more subtle ways. Sometimes it is possible to be equally vicious by coldly introduced content. A partner who knows what buttons to push, which accusations will cut the deepest, can be cruelly vicious, yet never raise his or her voice. When a partner hears viciousness in the words coming from the person who is supposed to be their greatest ally in the world, it can absolutely tear them apart. It isn't just that they disagree. It is a venomous communication of disgust and condemnation. Once this spirit takes over, relating stops and destruction starts. Here are some typical signals that you can use to determine whether or not viciousness is poisoning your relationship. Your interactions are marked by, at the least, a very harsh tone of voice and often by an in-your-face shouting. Your interactions are marked by such body language as a curled upper lip, a pointed finger in the face, or a deliberate Clint Eastwood-type killer stare, or exaggerated eye rolling. Your comments are laden with condescension, such as, well, you really turned out to be a great catch. Your comments are full of insults and name-calling, from bitch and bastard to fat and ugly. Your comments are filled with you statements such as, you make me sick, you disgust me, you are stupid and worthless. You purposely and pointedly attack your partner's vulnerable areas and values. As opposed to an act of overt commission, you may withhold from your partner that which you know they want and need to have peace in their life. And lastly, you seek to manage your partner with intimidation, both physical and mental emotional. I admit, these kinds of behaviors are often rewarded in the short term by a partner who concedes in order to escape the pain of character assassination. But just remember, your scorched earth mentality of winning through the destruction of the other person's confidence and self-worth really will create a scar that is as hard to repair and overcome as almost anything else that might occur. Bad spirit characteristic number 5. You're a passive warmonger. Those who are controlled by the passive-aggressive spirit are masters at what I call sabotage with deniability. These toxic partners will work long and hard to obstruct that which they do not desire, but yet do so in such an indirect way as to escape accountability if they are confronted. They always have an excuse. They always have a justification, but they do, in fact, relentlessly obstruct. Trying to trap the passive-aggressive spirit is like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. You just can't ever quite seem to get it done. You may know it, you may feel it, but you just can't prove it. Make no mistake, if you are possessed of the bad spirit of passive aggression, you are as much of an overbearing controller as the most aggressive, in-your-face person you could imagine. The difference is, you do it insidiously and underhandedly. Here are some warning signs that you can use to determine whether or not passive aggressiveness is undermining your relationship. After listening to your partner make a suggestion, you agree with the suggestion, then a few minutes later start talking about why it will fail rather than how it could succeed. You feign confusion when your partner explains even simple rationales for changing something in your relationship that you happen to like. You feign ineptness over activities that you don't like to do, painting a room of the house, for instance, or putting a child to bed. You time vague and subjectively defined illnesses or come up with competing events to interfere with plans made by your partner, plans that you don't like. You often start sentences with the phrase, "Yeah, but..." In other words, in your own passive way, you aggressively sabotage your relationship. Bad spirit characteristic number 6. You resort to smoke and mirrors. In this self-defeating menagerie of smoke and mirrors, you contaminate your relationship by hiding the real agenda and instead substitute superficial but safe topics to talk or argue about. You criticize one thing about your partner when you're really upset about something else. The result is utter emotional confusion. What is real never gets voiced, and what gets voiced is never real. By deceptively controlling the perceptions of your partner will spend untold energy trying to solve a problem that is nothing more than a decoy. A decoy that is set up because you lack the strength to get real about what matters. In one of my seminars, a couple good-naturedly acted out how they had previously lived this kind of constant hidden agenda. Neither Jim nor Lisa ever truly said what was on their minds. Here's how they acted out a typical conversation. Jim: "How did the day go, honey?" Translation: "I wonder if she's been goofing off again." Lisa: "It was really a nice day, dear." Translation: "When are you going to quit checking on me?" Jim: "You sure look nice, honey." Translation: "How much did that outfit cost me?" Lisa: "You're so sweet." Translation: "I guess he's horny." Jim: "Any mail today?" Translation: "I wonder where she's hidden the bills." Lisa: "It's around here somewhere." Translation: "Uh-oh, I hope he's really horny." You know the drill, and here are some more warning signs that you can use to determine whether or not the hidden agenda is creating deception in your relationship. your interactions constantly focus on superficial and trivial topics. Interactions that begin to approach the real issues are disrupted by anger, abrupt changes of subject, or withdrawal. You tend to talk passionately about the problems of other people that mirror what is really bothering you, but when confronted, you deny its relevance. You find yourself becoming very defensive if your partner directly asks you if there is anything bothering you. You're a master of defensiveness. You always know how to direct attention away from yourself if the questions get too personal. You're so good at self-protection that if someone asks you, "Why were you late yesterday?" you always have a ready excuse. "I wasn't late, and besides, it was raining." The hidden agenda may seem to protect you from having to deal with a dangerous truth, but in fact, it does nothing but compound it. If you hide inside a hidden agenda, you still have an appointment with pain. Pain that does nothing but grow in intensity each time it is ignored and suppressed. Bad spirit characteristic number 7. You will not forgive. I barely need to elaborate on this characteristic, do I? At this very moment, many of you are able to recall an incident from your past with your partner that was so hurtful to you, so devastating, that you can feel the tears stinging at your eyes. You want to rage against the person who hurt you deeply. You think your anger might act as a kind of mystical curse on your partner. You hope it will make your partner suffer. When you choose to harbor anger against your partner, you build a wall around yourself. You become trapped in an emotional complex of such pain and agony that negative energy begins to dominate your entire life. Your resentment can literally become so pervasive as to crowd every other feeling out of your heart. If a betrayal has taken place, there should be consequences. Certain freedoms limited, certain penance paid. But what I'm saying is that if you wallow in your resentment, if you refuse to forgive and move on, then you're going to tear up your life. Forget your partner for the moment. I'm talking about you. If you choose to carry on your resentments, then you guarantee yourself a life of misery. Here are some other ways this particular spirit can infiltrate your life. You are consumed with such anger towards your partner that you'll explode over the smallest disagreements or difficulty. You physically feel so upset and unbalanced that you often experience sleep disturbance, nightmares, poor concentration, and fatigue. You develop severe headaches, back spasms, even heart attacks, all because your body's chemical balance is dramatically disrupted by your stress. You cannot read a book or watch a television show or movie without finding something in it that reminds you of your resentment. You keep in your memory bank all the imperfections in your partner. You remember all of the mistakes and failures he or she made, and you bring them up constantly. Based on the slimmest thread of evidence, or often no evidence at all, you interpret statements and actions of your partner in a negative way. You think you shouldn't yet forgive your partner because he or she has not done enough things for you to prove that they are truly sorry and have paid penance. You do have the power to forgive. You have the power to say to your partner, "You cannot hurt me," and then control me. I am the one who makes the choices. I will not bond to you through hatred, anger, or resentment. I will not bond with you through fear. I will not be dragged into a dark world. By forgiving you, I am releasing me. This is one of the most important things you can learn here. By caring enough about yourself, you can break the bond of anger. You can break free from your prison of despair and rage. But trust me, the only escape route is through forgiveness. To take the moral high ground and forgive the person who has hurt you. And remember, you forgive not just for the other person, but for you. Forgiveness is a gift to you. Bad spirit characteristic number 8. You are a bottomless pit. Now it's time to turn to a different kind of bad spirit, the spirit of insecurity. If you are afflicted with this one, then you are too needy. You are so needy, in fact, that you consistently undermine your chances of success. For you, there is never enough of anything. You cannot be satisfied. You cannot be loved enough. You can never be attended to enough. You can never be supported and appreciated enough. You can never look good enough, and you can never perform well enough. You never relax, you never enjoy, and you never accept anything at face value. You feel in some strange way unworthy and undeserving of happiness and incapable of achieving your greatest dreams. You may also be consumed by a fear that it is only a matter of time until your true failures and shortcomings are discovered and your partner will abandon you. Sometimes you'll unconsciously try to drive your partner away just so you can get another dose of reassurance when one more time your partner proves his or her desire to hang in there. Your partner forever dancing, trying to find a way for you to be at peace. Don't get me wrong. We all want reassurance from our partners. That is perfectly healthy. But there is also a point in which it becomes toxic, where you constantly hunger for a fix of reassurance. If you are dominated by the insecure spirit, you also conveniently give yourself permission to not take responsibility for holding up your end of the relationship. How could you be expected to be a fully functioning, contributing, and mature partner when you're not smart enough or good enough? Here are some other signs that the insecure spirit has taken control. You fear rejection for voicing an opinion. You'd rather not say something than risk the disapproval of others, and when you do talk, you wonder if you're making the right impression. You talk yourself out of trying something new with your partner, from horseback riding to counseling, because you don't want to look stupid. When you are complimented, you immediately downplay whatever you did that led to the compliment. You state your beliefs as questions, asking your partner what he or she feels about certain subjects that are important to you, instead of declaring your position and taking a stand. Instead of expressing anger, you become tearful and play the victim. You are so sensitive and thin-skinned about any criticism that your partner cannot tease you or joke with you, and he or she sure as heck can't tell you the truth when the truth is exactly what you need to hear. If this spirit has its hooks in you, be honest with yourself and stop feeding the monster by constantly seeking the payoff of one more fix of reassurance. Right now, take the first step to break from your old inhibiting mindset and free yourself from the internalized sense of inadequacy and from the accusatory voices within you that tell you not to be too demanding or to want too much. Only then will you begin the journey of change and transformation. Indeed, as we move forward, I am confident that you will learn other ways to meet your needs of feeling self-worth and true value. Bad spirit characteristic number 9. You're too comfortable. Yes, it is possible to be too comfortable. You can become so passive that you get nestled into a comfort zone, where the name of your game is to play it safe, not to reach, and maintain the status quo. You don't challenge yourself. You don't strive for any kind of excellence. You become inert. And if you're not careful, you will find your days turning into weeks, weeks turning into months, months turning into years, and before you know it, you'll look up and it's all over. I know that so many of you are afflicted by this spirit. There have been surveys done with thousands upon thousands of everyday Americans, all of whom have a house, a job, 2.2 kids, and the barking dog, typical Americans from anywhere USA. And when they are asked if they are genuinely happy with their lives, they don't just say no, they say hell no. When they are then asked why they don't change, their answers are almost universally the same. In fact, the answers could be summed up in the words of one survey participant. I'm doing what I'm doing today because it's what I was doing yesterday. The problem here is that there are no sure deals, and that means a bad four-letter word, risk. In the back of your mind, there is the idea that you might not be able to change as much as you would like. What if you admit that you want and need more, and then you're unable to get it? Now you have acknowledged that your life is not what you want, and it's harder to just rock along. Your comfort zone might feel safe, but it's filled with compromise. If you're in a comfort zone, you are failing to meet your responsibilities in the relationship. You aren't contributing, you aren't stimulating, you're not energizing, you're simply not carrying your end of the deal. If you're in your comfort zone, then you can be certain that you've lost touch with your core of consciousness. You've stopped relying on your best instincts, values, talents, and wisdom. Here are some typical feelings and behaviors of this inert spirit. You never talk about such subjects as where your relationship is going, what your deepest desires are, what you dream about, what gives you passion. You may sit for extended periods of time, blankly staring at the television. You say to yourself you can't do things because you don't have the willpower. Your first reaction to almost any suggestion by your partner is no. You don't have the desire to go somewhere new or try something that's not part of the regular routine of your life. Anything involving risk to your current lifestyle is definitely avoided. As a result, your lifestyle offers no challenge and no stimulation. You say, I don't know, to so many questions. I don't know why that happened to me. I wish I knew why I did that. What you're really saying is that you've closed your mind and decided it's not worth the work anymore of trying to understand what's happening to you. You basically become a passenger in your life. I'm probably not the first one to tell you that life isn't like the pizza man. It doesn't deliver. You've got to make the move. And if you don't make a move right now to correct a bogged-down comfort zone life, it becomes easier and easier to just stagnate. To break the inert spirit, you must break through denial. Stop justifying your own passivity and stop avoiding the risk and challenge of change. Bad spirit characteristic number 10. You've given up. This is the state of mind in which you believe that you are in an intractably permanent position. You believe the circumstances you find yourself in are so unchangeable that you can do nothing about it. It's what happens when so many of the bad spirits that I've already mentioned have crowded into your life that you cannot imagine there being any possible way out. You've become so forlorn and lonely, so emotionally isolated and disconnected, so negative and cynical, so far from your core of consciousness, that you completely shut down that part of your brain that tells you there is any hope whatsoever. Here, you have basically decided that you have no core of consciousness. In this condition, you have stopped entertaining the notion that improvements can be made to whatever has happened between you and your partner. You have stopped learning or gathering new information. And most significantly, because you've shut down your information processor, you are unable to see even the most obvious opportunities to rejuvenate your relationship. You refuse to notice any change of spirit in your partner, and you refuse to notice any change of conditions or circumstances in your own life. You are like a caged bird that no longer sings, completely unable to realize that the cage door is now open. Here are some observable indications that you can use to determine whether or not this learned helplessness has consumed you. You have consciously accepted a dull pain as a way of life. You have surrendered to the reality of just going through the motions in a flat and dead relationship. You often think or say, What's the use? It will never change. You no longer even bother to protest when attacked or abused by your partner. You think it's pointless to try to change because it will only make the other partner get angry. You feel helpless and experience disappointment in the relationship, but would never state it overtly. You constantly become ill, for example, and have to spend days in bed, and may even turn to prescription pills or alcohol, or twice-a-week dependency on some therapist. This is a terribly epidemic problem. It is a pattern that is often seen in abusive relationships where one partner believes there is nothing that can be done except continue taking the abuse handed down by the other partner. You might be listening to this and thinking, I'm not one of these people. But if you are consumed with defeatist attitudes, I've already given too much and I'm just too tired to change. My partner will never change. Nothing can change our relationship. If that's your thinking, then you are already allowing your disappointment in your relationship to turn into pessimism, and trust me, despair is not far behind. I want you, right now, to listen to me. If this is your thinking pattern, you're killing your spirit. People do change, and so can you, and so can your partner. It is not too late. I recognize this has been a very tough chapter to listen to and reflect on. It has focused almost entirely on the dark side of living and how we can rip apart our relationships. But the bigger danger comes when we don't acknowledge that dark side. Then we will never be alert to its arrival. We will never be ready to resist it and cast it out. But there is good news. Because you are at the point where you're ready to move forward, to proclaim, no, I will not do this anymore. I will not let my competitiveness cause me to drive a wedge between me and my partner. I will not let my self-righteous attitude control me. I will not give in to my tendency to be dishonest and hide what I really think and feel. I will not become vicious and alienate my partner. I will not lose my self-esteem, and I will not be helpless. You do have the power to change. You may not always think of yourself as a leader, and you may not particularly feel like a leader in this relationship, but you are now. Because you now possess some powerful knowledge, and because you are in the process of gaining even more powerful knowledge, you have an opportunity to provide important direction in this relationship. Don't you dare cheat yourself out of this chance. You've come this far. Now let's go do it. You will want to listen to this chapter with both ears and stay focused. You cannot afford to miss a thing. It is time to stop being a contaminator in your relationship and start being a contributor. There is no middle ground. If you aren't constructively contributing to the relationship, then you are destructively contaminating it. And as your partner in this reconnection process, I want to activate the positives that I know are there, or at least can be there. The time has come to get your mind and your attitude right. Getting rid of the wrong thinking and bad spirits is not enough. It's time for the cavalry to arrive, the person you really are. I'm talking about you tapping into that core of consciousness that will push your own life and your relationship to levels of intimacy and caring that you never dreamed possible. It can happen because you can and should believe in you. I mean that literally and without exception. In relationships, just as in every other aspect of life, the spirit and attitude with which you do things is at least as important as your actual actions. If you adopt a new way of thinking and feeling about yourself, you, your relationship, and your partner will reap amazing benefits. Nothing else, nothing less will do. Now, I will be the first to admit that it would be nice if your partner were sitting beside you, listening to me right now. Also, I know that the human tendency is to focus on our partners rather than ourselves. Don't worry. As I said earlier, we will get to your partner. But remember what I told you at the very beginning. I'm coming after you. This chapter is about reconnecting with your true and powerful persona. The 10 personal relationship values that you are about to learn can be such a revolutionary pivot point in your relational life that you'll be able to create positive change beginning immediately. Purposely reaching into your core of consciousness will cause you to start living with more integrity, honesty, compassion, and with genuine enthusiasm. In essence, the 10 personal relationship values will reprogram you for success. You're going to like you a whole lot better than you have in the past, and I'm betting that you'll notice that everyone else in your life, including your intimate partner, will as well. Your constructive, healthy thinking will be infectious to everyone around you, especially your partner. Embrace and incorporate these powerful personal relationship values. They are what winners and winning is all about. They are what you will be all about. Personal relationship value number one, own your relationship. This may not be what you want to hear, but you are fully and completely accountable for your relationship. I cannot say this too many times in too many different ways. Owning your relationship means that you accept responsibility for creating your own experience. You are the architect of your thoughts. You choose the attitudes that you bring into the relationship. You choose the emotions and feelings that will control your thoughts in the relationship. And you choose how you act and how you react to your partner in your relationship. You own your relationship. You are 100% accountable for it. I don't mean here that you should take some fatalistic position of being trapped. This is not about you saying, okay, I got into this relationship and it's turned out bad, so I accept that I made a mistake. That's not ownership. That's whining. That's living in the past. This is about you taking a new, right now, life position. Let me tell you as bluntly as I can. This personal relationship value is the building block to your new life. Only when you stop seeing yourself as a victim will you start to see yourself as a fully competent and potent force in your relationship. Your less than perfect relationship will no longer be a source of despair. It will be your opportunity to use your power. Problems truly are nothing more than opportunities to distinguish yourself. It is time for you to do just that. If you are living this personal relationship value, you don't just get mad and act angry if your mate is chronically late for appointments or dinner. You must instead candidly evaluate what you are doing to contribute to the occurrence of this action in your partner. What payoff are you giving him or her? Remember, your partner doesn't just act. He or she also reacts to you, to what you do or don't do. By being accountable and acknowledging that you have responsibility for where this relationship has ended up, you clearly will be coming face to face with some things that do not make you proud. You will have to be honest about the things you have done that have contaminated this relationship. And you will then have to resolve to stop and change those realities, decisions, and behaviors. Becoming accountable can at first be painful, but I promise it will ultimately be very cleansing. The time has come for you to take charge, to find a new level of personal power. When you do, you will have matured to a new level of functioning that will stand you head and shoulders above those who haven't heard the whine warning and continue to stumble through life being the victim. Let those unfortunate souls spend their lives complaining about that which they do not control, while you take control and influence that which you can. That's what owning your relationship is all about. When you are accountable, you are a change agent. I'm willing to bet that's exactly what your relationship needs. Personal relationship value number 2.